Welcome to the bookshelf. We continue with African Rice Heart, written and read by Emily Wilkins.
Tinsel. It was Christmas Eve. I fell asleep on a mattress to the sound of all the foreign volunteers singing Christmas carols at the house of the mission pilot and his wife, Gary and Wendy Roberts. Maybe an hour later, I woke up extremely homesick. Gary gave us three girls a ride back to our village. That means there were four of us on the moto. I had no idea how to shake my homesickness on Christmas Eve, so I just sulked back to my family's huts. When I got there, Jolie was sitting by the coals with two of her cousins. I went over and sat down with them, and she introduced me, settling me into the warm and peaceful atmosphere of their company. The conversation went from America to marriage to my not showering that morning to what it would be like for my African family to visit America to Moondin, who was clanking pots together as he searched for food in the dish hut. He missed supper, so now he was incredibly hungry. I tried to make room for him to come sit with us, but Jolie said, "No, he's a boy!" And so he sat at the edge of the circle of the ladies. Eventually, however, he ended up in the circle with us. We were all crowded so close, touching shoulders as we hovered over the coals. And every time something was really funny, Jolie, shouldering me at the right, would place one hand on my leg and the other arm around my shoulders, and then throw back her head in laughter. I felt so loved there that my homesickness began to lift. The previous weekend, I had gone to Moundou, a city about 3 hours away. Jolie told me that she kept thinking about me over that weekend, and when she wanted to talk to me, I wasn't there. She told me that when I leave for America, she would lose a daughter. Ma fille, she calls me, my daughter. Ugh, I just love her. How could I feel this much love for a group of people in such a short amount of time? Christmas morning, I woke up early and finished putting tags on the tiny presents that I'd prepared for each member of the family. The kids started hobbling out around 6:30. Their little shoulders were caved forward as they held their hands between their thighs, trying to keep warm. It was such a funny sight, all these freezing African kids with their hands between their legs. So I brought out all my scrub tops and some of my other shirts, and the kids pulled them on for warmth. We looked like a child Chadian operating room team. Then I brought out all the paper snowflakes that we had made the day before and hung them on our mango tree. Actually, I made most of the snowflakes. These kids haven't learned how to use scissors yet. The branches of the trees are like a canopy, so imagine all the snowflakes hanging down at head level. We strung tinsel and ribbon all over the place. The decorating felt different than in America, but somehow it still had a familiar feel. After all, it was Christmas. By the time we finished decorating, the neighborhood had gathered around us. I realized that if my family was going to open presents under the tree, there would be a lot of disappointed people who didn't get presents. We had to wait for Sammy to come home from working the night shift anyway, so I went to the girls' hut where Esther and Dingo were resting on mats. When Sammy arrived, he came into the hut where we were, and I told him our problem. "Samity, I only have these little gifts for everyone in our family. I don't have enough for all the neighbors out there. I feel bad." He said, "Oh, don't feel bad, Emily. We can all just come in here, just the family. I'll get everyone." So all 19 of us piled into one little mud hut. I told them what Christmas meant to me, in pretty chopped up French, and Samity translated into Nangere. They listened so quietly, and I started handing them little gifts that had their names on them. I had anticipated that this wouldn't be as enjoyable because I thought it would be like me giving handouts, which I detest, and all the kids would just scramble for the gifts they wanted. However, I think because each gift had a specific name on it, they didn't envy each other's gifts. They gave me many, many sweet thank yous, and people rarely say please and thank you here. I have never had so much fun giving. I gave Samity one of those pack lights, which he loves. It's the brightest light he's ever owned. Moondin got this intricate mechanical music box, just the inside moving parts, and he couldn't stop winding it up and watching it, trying to figure out how it all works. Dinga got Floam, that moldable putty made out of tiny foam balls. No one knew what it was, though, and at one point, I saw that they were all trying to taste it. It looks and feels exactly like that big ball of rice called boule that we eat every day. By the time I said, "No, no, don't eat it," the taste had already told them that it wasn't edible. It was a festive Christmas, meaningful and family-filled, but I really missed my family in America a lot. I thought about all the toasty fireplaces and drifts of snow. I thought about the music that's playing constantly, and my dad always smelling like gasoline because he's always driving the snowmobile around. I'm missing everyone a lot. I keep reminding myself that the anticipation of reunions only builds with time, and that makes them even more wonderful when they actually arrive. Be patient, Emily. Be present, Emily.
African Rice Heart, Part 6, Horse Riding.
I used to look at the clothes here in Chad and wonder how in the world they got so many holes in them. I thought the clothes must be ancient. There were holes everywhere, not just in places like the neckline or armpits where you'd expect them, but there'd be holes in the middle of the chest and lots of them. But now that I've been here 4 months, my clothes are starting to get holes in them too. Just the other day, little Armel stuck her finger through a hole in the knee of my jeans. Wear and tear. Chad deals roughly with everything, including me lately. The last 2 weeks have just been especially and increasingly difficult. I've found myself spending more and more time away from the hospital. I used to stay and help with deliveries and observe surgeries, but now I just find myself looking forward to the end of my shift and becoming frustrated if the next nurse is even a little bit late. After yesterday's shift, which sucked my optimism dry, Stefan and I decided to go out riding. The horses seemed to calm us and free us from the frustrations we feel. We rode through the village and out the east exit, and the little kids, they ran as fast as they could alongside the horses, trying to keep up. One little boy ran out from his hut and immediately began doing the horse skip, you know, the one little kids do, and making that clippity-clop sound with his feet as he threw up puffs of dust. The branches of the mango trees hung low as we rode, demanding that you either duck really low and dodge them, or close your eyes and turn your head so you protect your eyes as you slide through them. Before mango season, the closing your eyes method worked wonderfully. The branches were full of leaves and just brushed over your body. However, now there are hard, green, unripe mangoes hidden in the leaves. And as Libby, the horse I was riding, took me straight through the trees, the fact became apparent to me, and I had this little moment of panic as my upper body passed through the leaves. I was just expecting a hidden mango to hit me right in the face or something. Miraculously, I went through the whole batch of branches and didn't hit a single one. My mind was so occupied with the thoughts of my invincibility that the next tree caught me off guard. Far too late to think of steering Libby in another direction, I saw a huge branch rapidly approaching, and this one was not simply composed of leaves. At its center was a thick, solid hunk of wood. Just in time, I threw myself forward onto Libby's spiny neck while grasping at her thin mane. Both Libby and I barely made it under the branch. So close. I laughed out loud, a bit out of shock and a bit out of the feeling like I was an idiot. That only in the movies do people ever get knocked off their horses by branches. But it wasn't entirely funny. I could have been seriously injured.
Appetite.
When you're a baby, you eat your fingers like they taste good. And babies keep going back for more. Baby Goma eats dirty, unripe, green mangoes here. Ones that have been dropped in the dirt multiple times. Goma will chew on them all day long. And I doubt that he likes the taste. We develop appetites for hundreds of things, for styles and foods, for boyfriends and art, to name four, and yet, sometimes, we forget to taste the things we begin to crave. Do I like the things I do? Do the fingers really taste good, or am I shoving my fist in my mouth out of habit? Am I eating the things I like, or am I passively gnawing at green mangoes?
Velcro.
This morning, I'm 23. I came home last night after a sweet birthday celebration at Wendy and Gary's house that included puffy chocolate cake. When I got home, Dinga and Esther were sitting outside where the teenagers talk at night. I sat down with them in the dark and they teased me, saying I must have an African boyfriend whom I visit at night and that they were going to tell Alex. Esther said that when she told Alex, he would want her and he'd be her boyfriend. This joke never gets old. We can joke about boyfriends every day and always think it's funny. After some good laughs with these funny African sisters, I unlocked my tin door and started getting settled for bed. When I began to get into bed, I remembered that I had done laundry earlier in the day and that my sheets and blankets were still hanging on a clothesline over at the hospital. Super. No sheets, no blankets. But I was much too tired to walk over and get them, and the sticky, hot evening air tricked me into thinking that it would be hot all night long. I was wearing my tasseled Indian capris, and my ankles began to tell me to cover them. I grabbed the Santa suit that my mom had sent at Christmas and wrapped it around my feet. Naively, I hoped I'd sleep through the night without any blankets. Wrong. I woke up freezing, really, really freezing. I pulled my arms inside the body portion of my shirt and tucked the sleeves behind my back so no drafts would come in. Trying not to think about the cold, I somehow made it till morning. But I got up and I thought, Emily, that was a rough night. But hey, you're 23. I went outside and looked around. From the position of the sun, I judged that it was about 7 in the morning. So I shuffled my way back into my hut, grabbed my running shoes, and banged them on the ground to get all the scorpions out. Okay, so none have ever really fallen out, but I have seen scorpions in my room, and I can just imagine how much that would hurt if one stung my toe. I sat down in the doorway to pull them on and then brushed my teeth. As I was putting my toothbrush away, my eyes caught sight of a bunch of shoes that I still hadn't given out. Lots of people from my hometown sent shoes for our little neighborhood running team, and it's been so fun to slowly distribute them to the kids who I know are going to use them. I want to tell you my thought process about the shoes right now, but I'm a little ashamed of it. I think it's valuable to tell, though, so don't think less of me. I got shoes of all kinds in the mail. I got Nike, Polo Sport, Keds, new and used, all different kinds. Amazing. Two of the shoes had Velcro instead of laces, and they looked a little bit elderly. They were navy blue with a fairly thick foam-like heel, comfortable but not sporty. I didn't know who to give them to because I thought that all the kids would want nice new running shoes, and I thought they'd get upset if they were the ones who got the old pair of Velcro ones. I guess I'd forgotten the appreciative and content attitude of the Africans. I thought of my dad. He's hip in his own way. Perhaps it's the way he sports colors from a different decade that's so intriguing, or maybe it's the way he tosses to the wind all thought of pleasing the fashion industry. He wears things that are absolutely outdated, and we laugh at him because his light blue work jacket is so tattered. Our cross-country ski set is from the 70s, and our biking helmets are shaped like mushrooms. Ancient. But I love that about both my parents. Life isn't about having the nicest things, and people will always have nicer things. So that's why I'm a bit ashamed that I looked down on the blue Velcro shoes at all. Anyway, this morning, when I saw the Velcro shoes, something clicked, and I thought of Kusimia. Kusimia led the pack the other evening. Barefoot runners. Kusimia led the pack the other evening. Barefoot runners. We were running little trails on the flat, dry fields when Kusimia said, "We are all birds!" He threw one arm out to the side like a bird in flight, while in place of the other arm, long ago amputated, a knob flapped under his shirt sleeve. Everyone followed his lead, and for the next 3 minutes straight, we were flapping our arms. We were like a stream of geese flying south. These kids didn't even think about how silly we looked. They loved it, and so did I. One-winged birds are really something amazing, and this was the first time I'd seen one. Kusimia is a flyer, even with just one arm. The kids make fun of him sometimes. Some bully will shake an arm around behind his body as if it's detached, or another will laugh when he misses a shot in basketball. But Kusimia just seems to shake it all off. He's learned so much basketball. He runs. He's learning English really well. He just flies. But Kusimia wanted shoes. He'd been running without them, but I could tell that he wanted them. And he'd frequently ask if his size had come in. This morning, when I saw that pair of Velcro shoes, I thought, this is the reason the Velcro shoes came. Taking them in hand, I asked the other kids where Kusimia lived. They directed me there, and I found his family standing around with their big bull, ready to take him out to the fields. I stood at a distance, because if this beast simply nodded his head in the wrong direction, he could put a hole in me with his horns. The littlest boy held the threat on a rope, and I asked him if he wasn't even a little bit scared. He said, "No," and hugged the massive animal from under his belly. "This kid is fearless." I told Kusimia that I had some shoes for him, and his crooked smile just shot forth. I strapped the shoes on him, and they fit perfectly. He loved them. Lace-up shoes just wouldn't have worked for him because he can't tie with only one hand. I said, "You want to go now?" "Yes." So we went. Kumakung, the fearless 6-year-old, came with us. He had incredible endurance, and he didn't even stop once. I couldn't believe it. It was such a good birthday run. I hadn't seen the value in those Velcro shoes. It seemed like I've got this in my head that we have to have the best. But today, on my birthday, I found that something was better than the best. And I'm so thankful for those of you who sent shoes, especially the Velcro pair. I'll never think of Velcro badly again, I promise. Housekeeping. After I finished my bui, I saw Jago and David cleaning out their hut, and I decided that my hut needed a deep cleaning too. All the kids wanted to help me, and that was fine with me. I'm all about cleaning in groups. It's so much more fun. I once told Fletcher, my tidy younger brother, that I would help him clean his room if he would help me clean mine. His response provoked feelings of both irritation and love. He said, "Emily, that's like Mexico telling the U.S. that we'll help you with your healthcare system if you'll help us with ours." Anyway, my African siblings all came to my aid in the deep cleaning of my mud hut. When I moved my teal suitcase, 4 big, drowsy, dehydrated frogs came hopping out, and all the kids wailed and pranced around, hugging the walls of the hut. No one wanted to touch them. Eventually, we made Tony push them out of the hut with his flip-flop. Then we moved my other suitcase and found that ants had burrowed their way into the ground, leaving mounds of dusty dirt. I began sweeping at these dirt piles with my hand broom, a stiff bundle of rice stalks chopped off evenly at the end and tied around the middle with a piece of fabric. As I swept, dust started rising, and Dinga grabbed the rice stalks from me, shaking her head and saying, "Kuratni," which means not good. She sprinkled water all over the dirt floor, and then we could sweep the floor without threatening anyone with death by dust inhalation. I don't know why I never thought of this. Every time I try to sweep, I can hardly breathe. Smarts. African street smarts. So we swept the hut clean, and oh, it looked awesome. Then Isidore started flipping through the calendar that hangs on my wall, and as he did, a little scorpion scurried down to the floor. Not comforting. Isidore chased it down and smashed it with a wooden hammer. He was so proud of himself, I could tell. I think all the frogs, ants, and scorpions are out now, and I'll sleep so well tonight. Edgy. About 9 o'clock last night, Carol, Ansley, and I were sitting together with the things that we had brought for the night of adventure we were planning. Ansley had a backpack, headlamp, blanket, mattress, Nalgene bottle, toothbrush, toothpaste, candle and matches, and a snack. Okay, she didn't really have a snack, but she had everything else. Then there were Caroline and me. We seemed to have similar theories on preparation. If you'll be okay without something, then you don't have to bring it. So if we can convince ourselves that we'll be okay trekking in the dark, then we don't have to bring a flashlight. And if we can last till morning without a drink, then we don't bring a water bottle. If we think we can tough it out through the night on hard ground without complaining, we don't bring a mattress. As you might guess, Carolyn and I had packed a bit lighter than Ansley. We had the scrubs we were wearing and gum, which Caroline said we were bringing to ease our consciences since we weren't going to brush our teeth. Oh, and I had insisted that we take a blanket and a sheet because I remembered that night that I substituted a Santa suit for a blanket. Bad news. We told Dr. Wilson, an awesome relief doctor from California, our plan. We wanted to spend the night up on the flat top of the water tower. The hospital's water tower is a giant box on stilts. Its top is about 40 feet up off the ground, and it has no guardrails. Dr. Wilson said that maybe he'd line the top with bricks to keep us from rolling off in our sleep, but we told him that we'd be all right. I suggested we all tie our wrists together, but that didn't go over well either. Near the water tower, we found a 20-foot-long metal ladder. Getting it to stand on end took all three of us, and even then it swayed all over the place. It would start leaning one way, and so we'd push it until it was upright, but then it would keep on going and nearly fall over the other way. But we got the ladder in place and climbed up it and then onto the water tower. The tank is capped by a semi-thin sheet of metal, our bed for the night. As we crawled across it, the metal kept flexing and making big booming sounds, which I knew everyone below could hear. I thought for sure someone was going to say something and we'd be caught, but no one came outside to see what was going on. We shifted around until we got semi-comfortable and then lay there staring up at the black night and the stars. The tower was tall enough that being on top of the roof actually made us feel like we were closer to the stars. We had an awesome conversation that night as we lay there. My dad says that there's something about campfires and hot tubs that makes them great for conversations. Maybe it's because they give you a reason to sit still for a while. Silences aren't awkward when you're sitting in the hot tub or by the campfire, because when conversation lags a bit, you still have a reason to be there. I think I'm going to add stargazing to his theory. It seems to open people's minds and hearts and settle their nerves. Eventually, everyone faded from consciousness, except me. It took me a long time. I've been having a hard time sleeping lately. My mind just won't turn off. Jolie says that if you think too much, you'll become skinny and sickly. Anytime she catches me daydreaming, she tells me that if I get sickly, my family will say that she didn't feed me enough. I want to make Jolie look good, but I have a lot to think about here too. At 3 a.m., Caroline told me that she was freezing and wasn't going to make it till morning. So she climbed down from the tower and walked home. An hour later, Ansley said she was cold too and was going to leave. I begged her not to go right then. "Wait till it's a bit lighter," I said, "then I'll go with you." So she toughed it out. When we climbed down from that tower, my body begged the sun to go back wherever it was coming from and to let me have a few more hours of sleep. But I've learned that good sleep is not usually part of a good adventure. Rice in the Eye. When Fletcher, my younger brother, was 4, he got a button stuck up his nose. He had shoved it in so far that removing it required a trip to the doctor, who had to use some special tool to reach in and pull it out. My mom sealed the button in a plastic pouch and taped it in his scrapbook so we'd never forget, because these things are funny when you're in your 20s. When I was 15, I'm a little embarrassed how old I was, I somehow got a mint stuck in my ear. I tried jumping up and down with my ear tilted down to the ground, but it just didn't work. My mom took me to the doctor, and just as we were walking up to the sidewalk of his office, I was still doing that jumping, shaking thing, the mint fell out. It just happens. Kids get things stuck in difficult places. Today, a boy came into the emergency room accompanied by his father. The boy was holding his hand over his eye, and his father kept pushing it away so that we could get a good look at it. The eye was swollen and leaking a little fluid at the corner. The father had a swollen eye, too. He explained that they had been working in the rice fields the day before. Big, hard swings to hack down the stalks. In the process, some rice kernels fly free, and apparently this can be very hazardous to the eyes. The two had kernels of rice embedded deeply and painfully into the whites and pupils of their eyes. Believing that the kernels might work themselves out on their own, the two had waited a whole day before addressing the problem. Now their eyes were irritated and puffy. Dr. Francois tried to use his finger to scrape the rice out of the boy's eye, but it was deeply situated, and the boy screamed and flailed. I held his arms and Job held his legs, but the boy still made it impossible to extract the rice. It was obvious that unless he was unconscious, we couldn't help him. So Dr. Francois referred the two to a hospital far away, one where they'd have an apparatus to hold the head still. Rice lodged in the eye. It's unlikely that you'd see that back home in the States, but it happens here in Chad. 20 cents. Tonight, when it got late, Onan, Jolie's daughter, who had been visiting for the evening, decided to head home. Merci, Esther, and I said that we would accompany her across the village to her hut. I love that African tradition. As we walked, I tried to teach them to say in English, "Why are you laughing?" I wanted them to be able to say it with attitude when someone tried to make fun of them for any reason. Yeah, so I'm probably not teaching them the most useful English words. But they kept mispronouncing the line, saying something more like, "Where's the bathroom?" So I just taught them that instead, having them say it back to me over and over and over again. Then I realized that I had 3 Africans repeatedly shouting, "Where's the bathroom? Where's the bathroom? Where's the bathroom?" as we walked through the village streets. I glanced around wondering who else thought it was funny, but of course no one else understood what Esther, Mercy, and Onan were saying. Then they started shouting, "The bathroom is that way," which they learned thanks to Nathaniel, the Dane who taught English at the local grade school. They say it with his British accent, which added even more flavor and fun to this moment. When we got to Onan's house, her husband met us. He made jokes and entertained us, reminding me of a jock or a ladies' man. Eventually, Esther said we were going to head home, and at that, Onan's husband asked if we would wait for a minute, and then he disappeared into his house for quite a long time. I didn't understand why we were waiting, so after a while I asked Esther, "Esther, should we go now?" She knowingly said, "No, just wait a little bit longer." So Onan's husband came out of the house, and he said that he'd walk us out. When we got to the end of the path, he gave each of us a 100-franc coin, worth about 20 cents, and he told us to buy ourselves some tea. So generous. I felt like we were back in the 1920s and my grandpa had just given me spending money. We all calmly accepted the gift with two palms up and thanked him a lot. As soon as we got far down the road enough to be out of earshot, Esther and Merci both held up their coins and broke into excited laughter. We have money! Their excitement was totally contagious, and I caught it in a flash, and so we all started jumping and running down the road and waving our little coins. I have never been so excited about 20 cents. When we got back home, we rubbed Dinga's loss in her face, teasing her that because she was lazy and didn't walk Onan home with us, she was 100 francs poorer. Hard. A sadness has built up in my mind and I just can't dissect it. I can't pinpoint exactly where it's coming from, but it's just left me struggling. I can feel the weight of the 18-hour-long night shift that has just come to an end, and as I walked home, every step felt heavy. I was heavy-stepped and even heavier-hearted. As I walked into the main entrance of our huts, Esther somehow understood with one glance. She came and grabbed my shoulders and asked me if I was hungry. I wasn't really, so she thought for a second and then said, "Come with me." As we headed out, some of the boys started coming with us, and both Esther and I turned around at the same time, threw our hands up in the same way, and in French said, "Girls only." Then we looked at each other and we laughed because our minds were so obviously on the same track. We walked aimlessly along the weedy trails and she let me vent a bit. She listened while I pieced together big and complex thoughts using choppy elementary French. Soon, we happened to arrive at her friend's house. Her friend, also maybe 16, was stirring supper, a mushy sauce and a boiling pot of rice. She wiped her hands on her wrap and greeted us with warm handshakes. Then she got us a bench and brought us water and even bread. I knew the little kids at this house because they hang out on the road where I ride horses. One of them is this super stringy, big-mouth, feisty girl named Lucy. While I was sipping water, she started running her little fists in circles and saying in Najre, "Fight me, Emily. Come on, fight me." She'd crouch down and scratch out the boundary of a boxing circle, and then she'd tap her hand on the ground all threatening-like, circle her fists in the air again and say, "Come on, Emily, fight me." I told her I didn't want to make her cry. I told her that she was small, like a mosquito, and that I wasn't afraid. If anything could have made me feel like tomorrow was going to be a good day, it was this little rough and tough girl who had it in her to fight me. Something about her spice reminded me that there's still some fight left in me, too. I really, really love the people here, but sometimes the work is really hard because I'm not fully trained, and I frequently have to solve problems on my own in an unfamiliar language. That, combined with the sadness that comes from seeing people suffer, can just take you down, wear you down, put holes in you. I'm trying to figure out how you get the downs to not bring you all the way down. How do you stay sensitive to the value of life and yet not become someone who's constantly mourning because you see people die all the time? How do you encourage parents to take responsibility for their children's health and yet not become hard-hearted towards people who need a break, people who need financial help? How do you become content in a place like this? As I wrote that last sentence, I looked at it and I thought, we aren't supposed to be content with a place like this. I am supposed to look forward to a day when I won't see all this pain. For now, though, I need to find peace about it all. That would be nice.
You've been listening to African Rice Heart, a young woman's journal of radical service. It was written and read by Emily Wilkins and published by Pacific Press Publishing Association, copyright 2011. Join us again next time as it continues.